And welcome to the Simple Actions group of Alcoholics Anonymous. My name is Ryan and I'm an alcoholic. At this time, for those who care to join us, let's open this meeting with the Serenity Prayer. God,
grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
All right, the Simple Actions group wishes to extend a warm welcome to all in attendance this evening. And for those of you who brought a dish to share with us all, just want to say an extra special thank you. Just so you know, these premises are non-smoking. Our group is welcome to use this room and the restrooms exclusively. They are across the main foyer and up a small flight of stairs. At this time, please silence your cell phones. Also, we respectfully ask that those in attendance... Ooh, I lost my place. Oh. Please refrain from unnecessary moving around the room. This will keep distractions and disturbances to a minimum and allow everyone to listen uninterrupted. This group practices the spiritual foundations of anonymity, singleness of purpose, and effective sponsorship. As a group, we believe that Alcoholics Anonymous provides alcoholics with a set of clear directions on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism on the basis of simple actions. These actions are contained in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. It is the purpose of this meeting to carry that clear message and to focus on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism on the basis of AA's simple actions. I will now read the AA preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. And for those of you who have visited us before, our normal format is an open big book step study, but tonight we have a speaker, Steve from Raleigh, North Carolina, here to share his experience, strength, and hope with us. Let's give him a hand.
I got water and coffee. It's like beer and shots. It's good to be here. I appreciate it. Wow, my name's Steve Mitchell. I'm an alcoholic. And I've got a home group. I'm a member of the Principals Group of Alcoholics Anonymous in Raleigh, North Carolina. My sobriety date's May 26, 1975. You're supposed to clap at that. I couldn't resist being a butt. I'm sorry. That's the only time I'll go out of line tonight. I'm gonna try to do the best I can. I do appreciate the invitation. I don't think it would be honest to say I was never invited anywhere when I was drinking, but I was not invited back. So it's good to, I've been to Norfolk before. I've been lost in Norfolk before. Been lost almost everywhere I went. But his telephone has gotten me, it's almost like, you know, that telephone getting me around is almost like from drunk to sober. As far as directions, and it let me down a bit today, but anyway, I arrived. So it's going to take me about 2 or 3 hours here tonight to get through this. I'm pretty sure you'll all be here with me, right? When I first got to North Carolina, I came to North Carolina in 1989, and this guy asked me, he said, I'd like to give you some advice if I could. I didn't ask him for any, and I don't know anything more worthless to an alcoholic than advice. Best I can tell, we don't take it when we ask for it, let alone unsolicited advice. But he said, I'd like to give you some advice if I could. He said, and this was true at that time, it's not true anymore. He said, almost all AA meetings in North Carolina start at 8 o'clock. And he said, you never have to worry about being alone in Alcoholics Anonymous in North Carolina unless you talk 5 minutes after 9. So I'll be mindful of the time. I'm pretty sure when I'm done here tonight, this is a great thing, you know, people come together and I don't know, maybe it's because Grace is here. I'm a friend of her sister's who lives in Texas. And every time I go to Texas, I always think I said, I'm in the land of good looking women and real men. But this is a really nice deal tonight. A good food and nice people and a lot of warm welcomes. And I'm pretty sure you won't be any smarter when I'm done here tonight than you are right now. But what I will do tonight, it's never easy to do this. I don't know how many times I've done this over the years. A guy told me when I first tried to make a couple talks way back in Nebraska, he said, if you ever climb up behind one of those podiums and you ain't scared, sit back down. Something's wrong. And, but what I will do tonight, I'm pretty sure one thing, I won't make anybody in this room worse than you already are. I mean, if you're bad enough to get in here, you're bad enough. I'm not going to hurt you. What I will do tonight, without any doubt, is I'll tighten my hold on whatever it is I have. One thing I've learned absolutely, we all learn whether we're able to put it together in words or not, is that whatever you send out comes back. Trash out, what did the wise man say? Trash out, trash back, love out, love back. It's impossible to give anything away in life. It always comes back. And AA is a very strange place. I mean, can you imagine sitting down in a bar some night about midnight and strike up a conversation with one of your best friends, you know, that you just met a couple minutes ago? He's probably another doctor or airline pilot. And you tell him, well, you got to die to live. You know, you got to give it away to keep it. And all of those things. You got to surrender to win. I mean, they'd think you need to be, you know, put away somewhere. So it's a crazy place. And if somebody were to ask me, this is just now the preamble, is I would never try to improve on it. It's about as succinct as you can get. It tells you exactly what Alcoholics Anonymous is, tells you what it isn't. But if somebody were to ask me, what is Alcoholics Anonymous? And I just had a sentence or two in my own words to describe it. What I'd say is Alcoholics Anonymous is a way of life. If practiced as a way of life and all the jets of AA are applied, then it's a little more powerful than the illness of alcoholism. That's what I think Alcoholics Anonymous is. Meetings are just one thing we do. They're integral now. They're important. I've always went to a lot of meetings, but you can stay in here and go to meetings and pound meetings until the cows come home and nothing will happen if you don't do the stuff. And if somebody asked me what I thought alcoholism was, what I'd say alcoholism means to me is I can't live with drinking or I can't live without drinking. The first time I heard somebody, it's been a long time too, but the first time I heard somebody say that the majority of alcoholics, percentage-wise, who took their own lives, did it sober, that made perfect sense to me. I didn't have many problems when I was drinking. I mean, other people had problems, but I mean, I didn't have that many problems. A lot of times, I didn't even know I was there. You know, so I mean, you'd have to ask somebody that was really there, I mean, what that was like. So I grew up in alcoholism. I come from a long line of alcoholics. You hear it in these meetings all the time. You hear people, especially in closed meetings, people will walk you right up to the door talking about their loved one, their mom or their dad or their whoever it is, and then they'll stop short and say, but I can't say they're an alcoholic because they never said they were. I'm going to take a chance on the people in my family. There ain't many of them ever said they were alcoholics, but they'll have to do until some come along. My dad was as bad a case of alcoholism as I've worked with a lot of alcoholics in my sobriety. I've never seen a worse case of alcoholism than my dad. He hated AA. He hated it till the day he died. He told one of my aunts, his sister, he said, if anything could make a man drink, AA would do it. And the first summer I was sober, he said, the problem with you, he said, you went from one extreme to the other. Now, I didn't know enough. If I would have known enough, I'd have said, Dad, I think that's the drill here. You're drunk and now you're sober. But I didn't know enough. I didn't know what he was talking about. So, I mean, I grew up in alcoholism. I come from a long line of alcoholics. I'm from a part of Nebraska where right and wrong is very clear. I'm not from the farm, but farm country. And you can make a lot of mistakes as long as you work hard. And they practice a kind of honesty. Now, I come from an honest group of people. Now, stick with me on that thought. It's a little crazy. But it's not the kind of honesty that will move alcoholism. You're going to have to do a little better than this. I don't like that term very well, but it cuts to the chase. It's cash register honesty. If you go in someplace and you pay with a $20 bill and they give you back more change, you give it back. It's that kind of honesty. I was introduced to it. I wasn't afflicted by it. I knew about it. And it's the kind of honesty, like if somebody on the farm was sick and couldn't get their crop in, somebody else would do it. My grandpa from the farm, literally, now this is not podium chatter, my grandpa on the farm literally would not go fishing on his own property without a fishing license. I mean, nobody ever saw a game warden out there. They probably didn't even know he had a pond on it, but he wouldn't do it. But Grandpa kept about that much whiskey in a bottle to get his right mind back in the morning. He'd have been appalled if anybody would have called him an alcoholic. He was very, very clear about right and wrong and hard work and being honest and all that. But that's not the kind of honesty that's going to move the illness of alcoholism, is it? We're going to have cellular honesty. We're going to have to drill down and decide at some point, we all did if we're in here tonight, at least for today, whether we wanted to live or we wanted to die. I mean, that's pretty, at the end, I mean, that's pretty clear how it came up. So little town outside of Omaha, Nebraska, I don't think this is possible. My youngest granddaughter, I think, either just turned 7 or 8, but I watched my kids and my grandchildren learn how to read. Best I can tell, I never learned how to read. I just knew how to read. I knew how to read really good. I knew how to read out loud in front of other people really good. I knew how to pronounce big words. I knew what words meant that I didn't know how I knew what they were meant. So they thought I was really smart, and I was like a little boy wonder. Now, here's what happened to me. In the fourth grade, they introduced a thing called long division. They might as well have been talking to me in Japanese. And what they wanted to know is why I wouldn't do it. I wanted to know too. But they took me to the principal's office, and it wasn't adversarial. They were that principal of that little town school was a gracious old lady. She gave her life to elementary education. And my teacher was there, the principal, and there was another woman in there. It's a long time ago. I was in fourth grade. And probably a counselor of some kind. But what they wanted to know is why I wouldn't do that long division. They didn't believe I couldn't do it. Didn't make any sense to me. Now, over the years, I've gotten a little arrogant about long division. I've begun to wonder why anybody would want to know how to do it. I took care of a large budget for years in the work world. I'll assure you, I never used any long division. But it became, later on, it would become apparent to me. I had trouble learning how to tie my shoes. I can't read a map. I hate to hear anybody say you can't miss it. You know, like on directions, I've actually went down the road. I pulled in to pee, got back in the car, and went the wrong way. I went past something this way, I've turned around, come back, and went past it this way. And just because I can get somewhere doesn't mean I can get back. Now, I don't want to brag about this, but stick with me on this. I'm a former ping pong champion, VA psych ward, Lincoln, Nebraska. I only lost one game of ping pong, and at that point, I immediately had my headband set in and remained undefeated from that point. But there was by this time now, I'd already got a lot of it figured out. But by this point, there was a young man, a head doctor in there, who explained it pretty succinctly to me. I worked with a guy for years that had part of his PhD was on right brain, left brain, and he said it didn't make any sense to him. I shouldn't be able to play catch. I should be, you know how like sometimes people will stab at the ball instead of waiting for it to come to them. But I'm well coordinated, so it wasn't that. But it just, something was wrong. Like the guy who explained most of it said it's like a pole doesn't touch. He said you might have been born that way, you might have been dropped. It's just like some stuff doesn't make sense. If I, if somebody shows me how to do something on a car, I've got to memorize it. If you go over here and it's laid out, but it's the same thing, it just looks different, I can't abstract that. So if you've ever checked into a nut house, you know those questions or those, you take those sequential kind of things, you know what I'm talking about, like you do the numbers things or at the, Cracker Barrel's got them on the tip. Yeah, I mean, I can't figure any of those things out, if I never could. If you want to figure out how I abstract, all they're trying to do with that stuff is figure out if you know this and this is that, how you abstract and like brain damage and all. But if you want to find out how I do that, you have to give me a family problem or something. I'm as smart as anybody else. But it took years for me to get all that figured out. I never did understand it. And I had to come along. I was pretty good in sports. I used to say I was really good, but I was probably good enough to play in a small little town. And here's what happened to me, though. I had three things happen about the same time. Now, I don't want to hit you with anything too heavy, but you might be able to weather one of these. You can't weather all three of them in sports. I quit growing, I got a bad attitude, and I started drinking. Now, that's going to shut you down. Now, it wouldn't be fair to say I'm a 15-year-old child now. I got a job as an elevator operator at a place called the Pathfinder Hotel. And some people in here, there's some pretty old people in here. Jim Willis is in here. And I think he's my great uncle's age. But you remember those old crank elevators that you drove with a crank, and if you drove it too high over the top, it'd stick, and too low over the bottom, now you just push a button. Well, it wouldn't be fair to say I didn't have any experience with girls at this point. I did. I'd made a couple runs past those little neighborhood girls, those little 15-year-olds, and I think I'd even went up a year to maybe 16 at this point. But here's what happened on that elevator operator's job. I got my first older woman. Now, she said she was 18 and she'd come in from the farm to look for a job. Now, I don't know how old she was, but she had not seen 18 for a long time. I don't know if they had that word cougar then, but they had that deal. And I sponsor this kid. Jim knows him. I sponsor this young man. We just had his 22nd AA birthday. He's an attorney today. He got sober when he was 18. And a terrible alcoholic. He destroyed his family and everything. That deal that Bill Wilson's talking about in 12 and 12 about young people being potential alcoholics, rest assured, he wasn't one of those. He was the real thing. But he wasn't sober very long, and he went to a class one night. Didn't have anything to do with alcohol. He was in this class, and he told me the next day, he said this woman rolled up to him at the class. I never know how to describe this, but he said that she said, I'll try to be as best I can, do you want to handle me? And she said, I'm 27 years old. I'm not looking for anything, but do you want to handle me? And he said, yeah. when we saw her, she might have been 37. She hadn't seen 27 for a long time. But I'd say that to say that, when it says in the book Alcoholics Anonymous that most of us have to be pretty badly mangled before we start to do anything, that makes perfect sense to me. Here you have a 15-year-old child that can't get through his own name in an introduction. In my day, they wanted you to ask your little girlfriend out, and then you're supposed to go to her parents' house, meet her parents, and then, well, I don't know what you do, walk off to the movie or the school dance or something. I couldn't have done that with a gun at my head. I wasn't about to do anything like that. But if something like that happens at the Pathfinder Hotel, I'll assure you, you ain't going to give up drinking very easy. When you got a guy that can't get through his own name on an introduction and all of a sudden you fill him full of Budweiser and he becomes an orator, I mean, come on. But my drinking was a problem right from the very beginning. And, there's this goofy story about my part of the country, in Nebraska, people are Catholic about like they're Baptist in North Carolina. And one night at the boxing matches, there was this... Catholic priest is right down in the front row. A lot of times there'll be one at Golden Gloves or whatever. So he's right down in the front row. And every time the bell rang and one of the boxers stood up, he did one of these deals. So there was a drunk down at ringside too. So he rolls over to the priest and he said, that guy that keeps doing that's one of your boys, ain't it? And the priest leaned back over and said, well, yes, he appears to be a Roman Catholic. And he said, well, what's he doing when he does that? And he said, well, he's blessing himself in the name of the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit. So the drunk leans back over and says, will that help him? And the priest said, it'll help him if he can fight. and that's kind of the way what we got here. Alcohol did the same thing for me that Alcoholics Anonymous has done for me. It's made it possible for me to live in the world. It's removed whatever was blocking me off. I did another fifth step three years ago with my sponsor and God, and I've never done an inventory in my sobriety where my listener hasn't pointed out fear. Never done one. My life has been permeated with it. Now, the thing about Alcoholics Anonymous is it makes it possible to operate in the world. I've never learned how to not be afraid. What I've learned about is faith and one day at a time living. My problems have always had to do with the past. I'm either mad or resentful about something that's happened in the past, or I'm afraid, I'm fearful about what's going to happen or not going to happen in the future. But if I live in the power of this moment, I do pretty good. You hear it in meetings all the time. People, this is how you hear that what I'm talking about in meetings. People will say, I'm at my best when I'm talking to another alcoholic. Well, the reason is we forget we're there. We're just trying to give something. I'm a baseball fan. And even big league pitchers will tell you sometimes when they get in trouble, they try to aim the ball. You can't aim it. You just got to bring it. And that's pretty much the way life is. I mean, if I get connected to the power of right now, then I've got the resources to do what's mine to do. What's the old saying? God won't send you where his power won't hold you. So once you've given your wasted and busted life over to Alcoholics Anonymous and over to God, then it's, I used to work with a guy that used to say, your life is none of your business once you've done the steps. It's God's business. Now, that's a perfect principle, and I certainly don't live that all the time. But anyway, what I would do is I would get in trouble, and I'd go back and forth. There's real big money in my family on both sides. Now, trust me, I've never seen any of it. None of it was ever earmarked for me. I was raised by good, hardworking, middle-class people, but there's big, big money. And there was never any of it earmarked for me, but there were opportunities. And what I would do is I would come and go. I started going to California when I was like 14 years old. I'd get in trouble and I'd go to California. And several people have thanked me for coming over here from Raleigh like it's some kind of a great deal. I used to walk across the city of Omaha on the rumor of a drink. I've actually hitchhiked from Nebraska to Los Angeles to drink Mad Dog wine. So, you know, driving a few hours to do something to save your own life and to see a bunch of gracious people that are actually glad to see you is no great reward. I mean, it's kind of our job. It's our job description to be of service. So anyway, I would go to California, then I would come back, and I'd go to California, and I'd come back. I'm in trouble all the time. It was a different time. I went off in the military. Well, I was barely old enough to get in there. A very dishonest recruiter told me that it was going to be impossible for me to get in the military. But if I would come up with as much money as I could come up with, he would give it to a detective at the police station, and they would throw my records away, and they would let me go off in the military. Now, the only part of the story that was true about that is one of the detectives at the police station was a retired Navy recruiter, and I don't think he was even in on it. I'll tell you how much I paid the recruiter, $65. They got cheated. But anyway, I went off in the military, and it was, I was running from the law. I'd been in trouble. I had a bunch of stuff, and they let me go off into the military, and I cheated on the test to get in the military, and they told me my job was going to be an aircraft mechanic. You know, I just told you, I can't change a tire. If I get a flat tire, I'm down till you get there. And they told me I'm going to be an aircraft mechanic. They sent me to a place called Wichita Falls, Texas. And I didn't know anything about Wichita Falls, Texas. So they get us all together. Now, even today, you'd have to wonder the genius on the military of this. They get us together and they say, this weekend, you'll be allowed to go any place in Wichita Falls, Texas you want to go, with the exception of Flood Street. You can't go on Flood Street. It's off limits by order of the base commander. Well, you know what I did? I got drunk and went down on Flood Street to find out why they don't want you down there. And a long story short, I got kicked out of that school, and they sent me to the great state of Arkansas, 1968. And I'd never seen anything like that. They had so many women. The women were wearing these little bitty minis and boots, and there was all this country music there. I mean, you didn't have to hunt for women. They had them bunched. And I was there a year. The first thing that happens to me, I get arrested for minor in possession, and I get arrested for public intoxication, and I get arrested for drunk driving. And I'd signed these papers. I was in trouble, and I loved Arkansas. I said at that time, when I get out of this airplane patch, I'm going to come back here to Arkansas and live. I loved it there. But I was in trouble. I knew I was in trouble. So I signed these papers that said I wanted to go to Vietnam. I couldn't spell Vietnam. I had no interest in Vietnam. I didn't know what was going on. Well, at that time, if you sign something like that, they move you pretty quick. But anyway, I went to Vietnam in January of 1970, it certainly would not, the military did nothing, they have no culpability whatsoever in my alcoholism. What they might have done is created an arena where it sped it up a little bit. They might have done that. And I was out of control. They would say, at least in the Air Force, if you get in trouble a lot, they send for your boss with you. And they would say, he's a good boy, he's just a long ways from home, and he's sowing his wild oats, was a saying in those. Well, that would have been true had it not been for alcoholism. So I get to Vietnam in January of 1970, and it's just, you know, the papers are full of the drug problem, and I'm just drunk. I'm drunk all the time. And I just told this. I was just outside of Dallas a couple of weeks ago, and I hadn't thought of it like this. But I actually walked all over Vietnam without a weapon. You can't look at the Vietnamese and tell whether they're friendly or not. I was in the freezer of a Korean ice cream truck one time, trying to get her. I was in a Vietnamese garbage truck. I mean, they called me the Su Chin Kid, and I had real long hair. I got an appointment with the squadron commander. I walked into his office. He's so new in Vietnam that he's wearing stateside fatigues. And so I get an appointment with him. I walk into his office. I do everything right, report in to him, and I tell him that if he don't get me out of there, I'm going to start picking people off with my M16, which ain't true. I don't have an M16. I don't know how to fire or assemble one. When you're supposed to be doing all that stuff to qualify to go to Vietnam, I was giving them stolen food, and the people down there were just signing the records. But he doesn't know what to do with me. He puts me on an airplane and sends me to Cameron Bay to see the psychiatrist. And the psychiatrist talked to me for about 10 minutes and put his head down, just shook his head, put on this piece of paper, return to duty. They thought I was trying to get out. I wasn't trying to get out. I don't know what I was trying to do. I'm just drunk. And so I come back to the United States, and oh my gosh, I ran into that guy. He was a good, I ran into that guy in Washington State, that guy, that major in Vietnam. He was a Mormon guy. And he said, "Mitchell, I sure remember you." I'm thinking that's not a good thing. But anyway, I come back to the United States, and I get stationed in Washington State, and now been in the military 2.5 years. I'm the same rank I was when I've been in 6 weeks. And I'm going to speed this up. There's a thing in the book Alcoholics Anonymous that says that the drinking career of every alcoholic has had some hilarious stuff. It's had some tragic stuff. I would submit that most of alcoholism certainly is not hilarious, and most of it isn't tragic. It's tragic to the sufferer and to their family, but most of alcoholism is just an erosion of what might have been. It's a lessening of what might have been. It's a settling for less. It's a lowering of the bar. And for years sober, when I heard people talk about progression, when I talked about the progressive nature of the illness of alcoholism, what I was talking about is how the drinking gets worse. You know how you see somebody at a meeting that you saw, they're coming back. And when you saw them last time, they still had their family, or they had their job, or I don't know, maybe they had their teeth. I don't know. They had something that they don't have now. And when you see them now, they're more beat up. Well, that's a product of their drinking, right? But there's a lot of other stuff that's going on with the progressive nature of alcoholism, too. The rage is getting worse, the isolation, the fear, the blaming others, the confusion. It's a lonely illness. You know, David's been this gracious host, great guy. If we were talking today, the guy that brought me to North Carolina, first ex-convict in the history of the world that we know of that ever became a prison warden, recruited me and brought me to North Carolina in 1989. But he's in Alzheimer's. It's a horrible, horrible thing. He spent over $1 million of the state's money in one day. Now, he had the authority to do it, but that's a lot of horsepower. Move over $1 million of taxpayer money. He decided how to move it. That's a lot of decision making. Now he doesn't know. When I see him, when I get down to see him, he doesn't know if he's had any coffee. I mean, he's in Alzheimer's, so it's a terrible thing. But I say all of that. We went through that with both of my wife's parents, and I mean, it's just it's horrible that somebody that was top of their game and. But when you look at, like, I'd go out once a week to spell my wife. I'd go out once a week, and her dad was a cancer researcher, so he had any financial problems. He lived in a state-of-the-art retirement villa. But it's just a death rattle, no matter what it's like. But I'd go out once a week with Daddy to have lunch with him. Well, when I would walk into the dining room, I would break up his loneliness and his old buddies. Anybody in this room could do that. You can't do that with the illness of alcoholism. You're alone in your own family at Christmas time. You're alone in a war zone. You're alone wherever. You're alone in Yankee Stadium. My sponsor, who died, how I ended up with Tom, used to talk about laying in bed next to a woman he loved and he thought loved him. And he'd explain, talking about isolation and the loneliness of alcoholism, he'd say they'd lay in bed with their legs touching after he'd been drunk, neither one of them saying a word, not knowing what to say. Just that loneliness, that isolation is so loud. So all that stuff is getting worse with alcoholism. Not just the actual drinking, but all the other stuff, the residual that goes with that is getting worse. I didn't catch that for years. But anyway, you know, when it says in the book that some stuff is hilarious and some stuff is tragic, I'm going to tell you a story that I think is hilarious. Now, if anybody doesn't like this story, I don't know what to tell you about it. Tell somebody else, don't tell me. You know how when something embarrassing happens, you really wish your sponsor wasn't there? I told this story one time in Rhode Island, and anybody that knows Tom Ivester, who I'm talking about, knows Tom's a moralist. Right. When I was so glad Tom was there, I'd been telling this story for years. I didn't know you could get in trouble for telling it. Nobody'd ever taken any exception to it. This woman was irate about this story. She didn't like the story. So when she walked off, Tom said, "Don't listen to that junk. If you want to tell that story, tell it." So here's the story. If you don't like it, tell somebody. I don't know. Talk to Grace about it. I'm pretty sure I can get it past Grace. And then I'm going to tell you a story that's tragic. I'm in Spokane, Washington. I'm very drunk. I have this woman with me. This is another story I never know exactly how to tell. This woman was not, put it like this, she was not ugly. However, she was old. Now, I told this story one night in Decatur, Alabama, a long time ago, and there was a woman right down in the front, and she said, "You mean mature, don't you?" And I said, "No." No, I don't mean mature. Well, anyway, here's what happened. I'm driving a very large white car. I drive it up to the bar. Get out of the bar, out of the car with this woman. We go in this bar. It's out in the country, outside of Spokane, Washington. Most of this story was pieced together for me by the highway patrol. A couple hours later, we come out of the bar. We get in a large white car and we leave. Only problem is, it's not the large white car we drove to the bar. You couldn't make something like this happen. In those days, I never took the keys out of a car. So a couple hours later, the middle of the night, I'm arrested for drunk driving and auto theft. And they put that elderly woman and I together in a jail cell. They took us to this little cow town. It's the only cell they had. They had to put us in there together. They're going to put us in there. And this night watchman sat out there and watched us, and the highway patrolman tried to get to the bottom of what had happened. It took me a long time to figure out what had happened. I could see how I'm getting arrested for drunk driving, but auto theft? And so the next morning, they let us out of jail. And you know how you tell something so many times you can't be sure something, you know how you think something, you can't be sure it really happened. This story is true in every detail. The only thing I'm a little bit uncertain about, but I think they even gave us the beer back. I didn't get drunk driving arrest. The only thing I got was a ticket for leaving a motor vehicle unattended with the keys in it. Apparently it's against the law in the state of Washington to leave the keys in a car. I guess if there was any silver lining in the story, I left the car I drove there for the guy that I took his. And he was driving on suspension. His son had to come and get him. the whole thing's a mess. So anyway, they let us out of jail that morning. And this woman I had with me, we're standing in front of the jail, and the patrolman, she's walking off. She's about probably a little bit farther back there than where David is. And she's walking to the car. She has on these little bitty white shorts. And about maybe half her butt's coming out the bottom of those shorts. It's rough. And I don't know why I did this, but the patrolman, he's talking to me. You know how they talk to you. He's talking to me like this. And at my side, he's saying, she's going to have to drive. You're still too drunk. And I'm sure I'm saying, "You're right, boss. I agree with that." So he tells me to get going. So I start walking to the car. Now, I don't know why I did this, but I got about back there where those coffee pots are. I have no idea why I did this. I turned around and stopped, and I looked back at the patrolman. And he's standing in front of the jail like this. And when I turned around and looked at him, our eyes locked. They just locked. You know how your eyes are locked in a restaurant with somebody or in a library? We just locked. Like this, and I saw him go. And I thought, buddy, if you think it's rough for you, how would you like to be me? Now, to be fair, I mean, that woman didn't have a day on the beach on her hands with me either. But that wasn't hilarious then. It was funny now. But that's a hilarious story. I mean, I had time after time after time crazy things happen. I was in two car wrecks in one night one time. I was in the sleeper of a tractor trailer when the trailer came through there and crashed right above where my head was. None of that's hilarious. You could literally look out and see the sky. They had the highway patrol out there, and they had fire engines hosing off the diesel fuel. I slept through the whole thing. I didn't even know I was there. Nobody knew I was there except the guy driving the truck. And he said that he watched a trailer come around in the mirror, and he said he didn't even spill the beer between his legs. But those things happen time after time after time. Now, here's something that happened that's I'm going to shoot through this pretty quick. I'm not going to take a fifth step at this podium. You wouldn't want me to do that. It's inappropriate. That's why we tell that to God and one other human. I was involved with some people. We'll just leave it like this. They're outside the long arm of the law. And I'm dealing with a lot of anger and hatred. My alcoholism's out of control. Nobody can tell me anything. I had no business being in the military. Even then, it was obvious to me that people were getting killed. I don't know how to describe this because it sounds so arrogant. People that have given their life to the military, they might have seen this kind of stuff. I don't know. But there was no doubt I was in more trouble than people were who were getting kicked out of the military. Now, there's two people in the military, in my experience, that have real power. One's a chaplain and one's a medical doctor. And there was a medical doctor who really championed me. He actually told me one time if I'd straighten up, him and I were going to get out of the military about the same time. He said if I'd straighten up, he'd buy a couple gas stations in the St. Louis area and I could manage them. I was in trouble one time and I don't know what he called it. He diagnosed me as having some kind of illness, put me up on the floor by myself in a tent. People were scared to come up there. I'm just up there drunk. They thought I was toxic. But anyway, I'm just crazy. I'm out of control. And because of alcoholism, because of hatred, and because of the way I was living, I was a good bit, partially at least, a good bit responsible for the death of another person. Now, I don't think it would be honest or fair to say that didn't bother me, but it didn't bother me like it was going to come to later. Another thing we all learn in the spiritual life, the harder something is shoved down, the more vile it's going to be when it comes back up. I mean, you can't get away. I mean, that's why our founders were so... If you ever wonder about the brilliance of our founders, that we have a program that's put together about action and not feelings, that you do certain things and then certain things happen. You know, I don't think Bill ever wrote again. You know, all the stuff we've got today, like with people changing their sex and all that, Bill Wilson wouldn't have thought a thing in the world of that. He was as broad and forward-thinking as any human has ever been. And best I can tell, he never wrote again. That's why it's so crazy, this thing that's going on, been going on around the country, about if you're a real strong AA member, you need to be down with the big book and the 12 and 12 garbage and all that. That's all just nonsense. Bill never, as best I can tell, Bill never wrote again the way he wrote the big book. The big book is right at your jugular. It'll tell you what'll happen if you do what you're supposed to do, and it'll tell you what'll happen if you don't do what you're supposed to do. But the 12 and 12, quite naturally, that's much broader and more. Bill was sober a lot longer. His thinking was, and that was much more the way Bill thought. But anyway, I just kind of went on, and my life just kind of spiraled out of control. And my plan was, when I got out of I creaked out of the military with an honorable discharge in the summer of 1972. It was going to be almost 3 years before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous to stay, and I worked a period of 6 weeks. I had 1 year where I earned $82. I got into AA. I was actually in a flop one time. I'm not exactly Methuselah's age, but I got in a flop one time where the rent was $7 a week. And when I got sober, I met a guy that had been in that same place, and he couldn't wait to talk to me. He wanted to know what the rent was when I was in there. And I told him it was $7 a week, and he said, well, it was $5 a week when I was in there. And then he pointed out neither one of us could make the rent. So, I mean, it was just... But anyway, here's what happened. I got out of the military, and I went back to Nebraska. And my plan was to go back to Nebraska for about a week and come back up to Spokane, Washington, and fall in full time with these people. I don't have the military now hanging over my head. I can give myself over to this, and I'll make a lot of money. But I was too far gone. My alcoholism was too. I've always been grateful. By the time I got back to the Washington State, I was a responsibly recovered member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I work with a lot of alcoholics. I know, just like some of you do in this room, there's one, and I know that alcoholics can get respectfully drunk in North Carolina. But there's one big difference between drinking in Nebraska and drinking in North Carolina. I would be willing to bet we've got 20 bars in Nebraska for every bar you've got in North Carolina. There's bars everywhere. I'm getting ready to go to Nebraska again. I have one sister that stayed there. She lives in a town of 263 people, three bars. I actually sobered up at a place called Bill's Bar, and on both sides I sobered up at a place called Chapter 5, and there was a bar on each side of it, and you could sit in there at night and hear the country music come through the door. Down on the other side of the street was a place called Bill's Bar. Have you ever seen one of those bars where you could back a farm truck up and everybody in there would go to AA and you wouldn't miss a person? You ever seen a bar like that? Bill had made his fortune in the garbage and septic tank business. And he bought that bar as a toy for his drunken wife, Phyllis. Now, we had some colorful characters in there. People that worked in there were drunk. Everybody was drunk in there. We had a guy named Vibrator Hartman. And Vibrator got drunk one New Year's Eve and burned up in a fire. We had a guy named Rodney Montaney. Rodney got drunk, got in a fight with a guy in a wheelchair, and tipped him over. We had a guy named Leonard Larson. Leonard had no neck. His head sat right on his shoulders. Now, and Leonard was just barely street legal on a good day. He should not have been running around, I'll assure you of that. But Leonard used to get me to jump off bar stools onto his stomach to perform feats of strength. But I don't know how many people in here ever been to that roundup at Blackstone, Virginia. I think they've moved it now, but I've only been there once, and I happen to be the Saturday night speaker. They had you up on a stage. And my wife was with me. Now, she ain't in AA, but I've just learned over time, if at all possible, it's a good idea to do what she says. So it's about 2 or 3 minutes to 8. I'd already climbed up on the stage, the people chairing the meeting, the readers were up on the stage. They had a seat for my wife right down in front with some friends of ours, and she's frantically calling me down there. I said, Julie, there's only 2 or 3 minutes. She said, come down here. So I go down there, and she leans over and she says, I don't want to hear one word out of you about that guy that ain't got no neck. I said, what are you talking about? And she said, I mean it, not one word. I said, what are you talking about? She said, look at that guy over there, he ain't got a neck. Anyway. But the two most colorful people came into Bill's Bar. They hit Bill's Bar about the same time I did. I got out of the military. Two brothers named Billy and Tommy Walker. Now, I like to drink with these guys for two reasons. One of them is, when I was drinking, I had a big mouth. Now, there wasn't anything going to happen to me in Bill's Bar. Phyllis wouldn't allow it. Plus, I knew everybody in there. I was pretty well protected. But we'd get drunk and wander off. But Billy Walker never was any bigger than I am right now, but he would attack people. He'd look like that dog on the Greyhound bus. He'd fly on people and knock them out. That'd be the end of it. The other reason I like to drink with him, I've seen a lot of guys could did really well getting women in that way of life, but I've only seen two, best I could tell, they attracted women. They didn't have to do anything. They just went wherever they went, and the next thing you know, there's women around. And Billy Walker was one of them. So even then, I must have just been drunk, not stupid. Because my plan was, I'll stay here with you, Billy, and maybe I'll get some of the overflow. But anyway, this is the kind of brains you had in Bill's Bar at that time. Now, I'm a beer drinker at that time, but I'll drink anything. And there was literally, in those days, I could drink beer for 24 or 30 hours. I'd be drunk, but I could remember stuff. I could talk to people. I could drive a car. But you let me take one drink of whiskey, one drink of wine or whatever, I just never remember. So Billy Walker drank dry gin and chased it with squirt. Tommy Walker drank bar whiskey and chased it with water. Well, when I started drinking with him, I started drinking that dry gin and chasing it with squirt. And this is the kind of brains you had in Bill's Bar at that time. I like to tell this story because this is really where my move to AA started. It started much before that, but people in Bill's bar had a lot to do with me getting an AA. I guess we all know AA would be a very different place if alcoholics who got some of us in here would have got in here themselves. It would also be a very different place if a lot of us were put in here by non-alcoholics. I don't think the non-alcoholic gets as much thrift, bad thrift, as they used to get in AA, but we need to be awful careful about that. Even a casual observation of AA history makes it clear we'd have never got AA going without the non-alcoholic. A couple, 3 years ago, I spent a weekend with Jim Estelle. He's the former non-alcoholic chairman of World Services. He gave us something like 15 years of world service off and on. If you watch those prison shows on the ID channel, and you see those in Texas, you'll see the Estelle units. Those are named after Jim Estelle. He's the former Secretary of Correction in Texas. But non-alcoholics have been, getting us in here for years. But anyway, the brains in Bill's bar at that time, what Billy Walker told me, he said, the way we're drinking this dry gin, he said, what you got to do, he said, you get the gin in a shot glass and then you get a chase or a squirt. Never breathe when you're drinking it because it's nasty. And you want to drink it real fast, and as soon as you drink it, chase it with that squirt. And anybody that's ever drank any dry gin knows he's telling the truth. If you get a good whiff of that and you're sober, it'll just send chills through you. You got to be about half drunk to drink it. Now, I said, okay, Billy, that's fine. The other thing threw me a little bit. He said, now, the other thing is you got to start to use a lot of pepper on your food. We ain't eating much in those days anyway. And I said, what will that do? And he said, well, the way we're drinking this gin, he said, it'll hurt your liver. But if you put a lot of pepper on your food, it'll counteract any damage. Now, that's the kind of brains you had in Bill's bar at that time. Now here's what happened. Thanksgiving season, 1974. I'm just back from California one more time, pretty sick. And a lady in Bill's bar and her boyfriend was a bull hauler. And at that time they called them 48 states in Canada. They used to haul more cattle and hogs out of Nebraska than any place in the country. Hauled them all over 48 states in Canada. Sal was a bull hauler. And Libby invited another guy and I to their house for Thanksgiving dinner in 1974, and I'm real sick now. She had a great, big, beautiful dinner. Now remember, Libby and her boyfriend are permanent party in Bill's bar too. Everybody in Bill's bar, I believe, then and now, needed to be an AA. You could get in there by mistake, but you wouldn't stay in there. It's not the kind of place you'd go. It's not the kind of place somebody'd go after work and have a beer. That's not what's going on in there. Bill had made his fortune in the garbage and septic tank business, and it was a rough place. But I'm sick. Libby made this big, beautiful dinner. She had her kids in. I can't eat. I'm sick like this now. I wake up. I'm drenched in my own sweat, but I'm freezing. I go to the bathroom. Blood comes out. I vomit. Blood comes out. She's bringing in beer for me to sip on. I think I'm going to get well. I get sick again. If you can't keep it down, you can't get well. And it's a funny thing because I like to think from here this stuff is indelibly etched on my heart. Libby rolled up on me one day and she said essentially this. She said, I've been around alcoholics all my life. I've been married to two alcoholics. Now, Libby was not a pristine woman. She would stick a fist in your mouth or have one of her boyfriends do it in a second. I'll tell you a little what this crowd was like. Sal wanted to marry Libby. I knew she wasn't going to marry him. She changed men about like you change clothes. But Sal drug her across the river over to Iowa to meet his mom. And so Libby told me they're over there one Sunday afternoon, and Sal goes to the bathroom so his mom pulls her into the kitchen and said, honey, I want to give you some advice. Now this is his mom talking, right? If you know what's good for you, you get as far away from that drunken bum as quick as you can because he'll ruin your life. So I mean, that's what you're dealing with here. But Libby had a talk with me that went very much like that. I've been around alcoholics all my life, but I don't ever think I've seen anything like you at your age. I was 25 years old. She said, there's a man in town who helped my last ex-husband. My last ex-husband's now been sober 1 year. He's got a full-time job, he's paying his child support, he's doing really, really well. Now, if you want me to, I'll call that guy. Now, if I were to say I'd been looking for a way out, you'd know what I'm talking about, wouldn't you? You know how we're looking for a way, and that's why I've always thought so many of us come here and we say we don't believe in God, when my experience is usually we're just real mad at God. Well, it makes sense, because we've tried to get help. Now, misguided, but we've tried to get help, so quite naturally we come here enraged. But anyway, she said, I'll call him if you wanted to. And I've been looking for a way out a long time. I had some plans on how I was going to get out. My one plan was I was going to marry a rich woman. Now, I was pretty confused, but I'm thinking, that doesn't look good. That's probably not going to happen. My other plan was I'm going to get a job. And I'd do it over that day after day in my mind. What I'd do is I'd say, tomorrow, what I'm going to do is I'm going to sip a couple beers, take the edge off, and I'm going to go get a job. That made perfect sense. Day after day. That's like saying I'm not going to drive a car while I'm drinking. That makes perfect sense, so I start drinking. Then it doesn't make sense anymore. And then the third thing I would submit was a lot more likely. I said, I'm going to take my own life. And I would submit that was a lot more likely to happen. This is worthless information. When I grew up, we were told that people who committed suicide were cowards. I've never thought that was true. That looked like a way out, but I guess I was grateful I was scared to do that. But anyway, here's what happened. On November 30th, 1974, a guy by the name of Bob Brannigan pulled up. She'd called him. And he spent all Saturday afternoon with me. I sobered up right at the end of very active 12-step work. Later, I was to go, from the day he came till I got sober was about 6 months. And when I got sober, I went on many of those calls with him. I had no idea what was going on. He was a rabid Big Red football fan. It was the years of the Big Red Machine and Johnny Rogers and national championships and all of that. But he didn't do the football game. He made the call. I don't remember very much of it, but I know now that what he did is he told me what he used to be like, what happened, and what he's like now. If you ever wonder, again, the genius of our founders, if you ever wonder, what is it a newcomer needs to know when they come to Alcoholics Anonymous? Here's what a newcomer needs to know. What we used to be like, what happened, what we're like now. Now, they probably ain't going to believe all of it, but that's what a newcomer needs. That's what I needed to know. And I don't remember much. I remember a few little things. I know he spent all Saturday afternoon with me. I remember him saying that he'd had a wife and 5 kids. He'd lost them because of his drinking. He'd built a new house. He was a sheet metal worker by trade, so he knew all the disciplines, and they built a new house. And he said, I lost my family and my home, and I should have lost it. I thought that was a little strange. And I remember a couple other things I asked him. I guess a question anybody who didn't know anything about alcoholism would ask. I said, how do you get the willpower to stop drinking? He said, I look on willpower a little bit different than you do. What I think willpower is the way you take that drink knowing it's going to come back up. That's what I think willpower is. And I remember asking him, how long since you drank? And he said, if I can make it till September, it'll be 11 years. Now, yesterday for my birthday, one of the guys I sobered up with called me and he told me, Brannigan, is just getting ready. That guy that made the call is getting ready to celebrate 55 years. He can't drive now. Last time I talked to him, he said, you know, his kids and grandkids wanted him to quit driving. He's getting lost, his mind. Well, he said he's going to quit. But I guess he's still sober for the simple reason he's still doing what he did with me. And the next day, he carted me off to the state hospital, another guy same age as me who's now dead from drinking. But on the way to the state hospital, I don't remember much of that, but I remember you remember those cars from that time? They were about a half a block long. I've always thought it cost about $5 to start the motor on one of them now, but I needed a drink really bad. I had horrible cramps. I didn't get a drink. It was about 130 or 40 miles out to the state hospital. But he bought me a carton of Marlboro cigarettes and a can of 7-Up, and you know what I told him? I'll pay you back. And I'll never forget, he looked over at me, probably about as long as you could take your eye off the wheel, and he said, that ain't the way this works. He said, you'll be expected to help someone else when you're able. And from then, it was about 6 months that I was to get sober. I got sober May 26, 1975, and May 26 was a Monday that year. I woke up at 2 a.m. I had 2 bottles of wine. You ever hide a bottle from yourself? I couldn't find him. I searched madly for him. I didn't know what had happened. I saw this guy I'd been drinking with, and he's dead now too. I said, what happened? He said, well, we were riding around in the car with Richard. And he said, you know, Richard's nerves are bad. Now, that couldn't be argued. Richard's nerves were bad. And he said, I always did pretty good with Richard, but he said, we were riding around with Richard, and he said, Richard told you 3 or 4 times to shut up, and you wouldn't shut up, so he hit you. I said, Richard hit me? He said, yeah, right in the mouth. Hard. And I said, what did I do? He said, you started crying. But now, here's what happened. In that little time frame, I'm not sure exactly when it was, but it was in that little, I got to rush to the hurry here now. In that little in that little time frame, 3-4 days, a week, 10 days, I don't know, my great aunt invited me to come and live with her. My great aunt was 75 years old. She was born in 1900. She followed the years, and she invited me to come and live with her. She said, I have someone in mind who will take you to AA if you will go. And my great uncle, her husband of 50 years, had just died. And I was already going to meetings. She didn't know it. But my great aunt was a very dignified, cultured old lady. If she were living today, she'd be in a physician or an attorney or a professor or something. It was a different time. She was. She spoke English fluently, obviously. She spoke Spanish fluently. She spoke German fluently. And she was a lifelong student of Latin because of her love of words. She knew about AA from her reading. And what she said is, as you come here and you know, get your life. And that's what I did. I didn't do much work the first year. I got a job in a, of all places, listen to this story. They made a guy in the program give me a job in a junkyard. Can you imagine now what I've told you? They put me in a junkyard. He'd send me to get a carburetor. I'd come back with a fender. You know? I mean, he needed me about like he needed another hole in his head. And he took me off of that and put me on lawn work. I started a fire. It was. I'm going to head for the home. Now, here's what happened. I just saw this happen not very long ago. I sponsor a guy that got out of the penitentiary in 2008. We worked out sponsorship the day after he got out. Just a couple, 3 years ago, he was inducted into the National Martial Arts Hall of Fame. But he did every scud job known to man when he got out of the penitentiary. He's working in a gas station in the middle of the night, stocking shelves and cleaning up down there in the ghetto. Hell, I'm afraid to go down there in the daytime. He did every scud job known to man. Got a job as a busboy at Perkins on weekends. The general manager found out about his record and fired him. I mean, he did every scud job known to man. But he just kept coming to meetings and doing what he's supposed to do, just barely staying, eating, and a place to live. And one day, a guy in my home group, very wealthy man, walks up to him, fat, dumb, and happy, and says, how would you like to come to work in my corporation? He said, I'd love to come to work in your corporation. He said, report out there Monday. He said, go to the office. My secretary will help you fill out the paperwork. The guys in the warehouse will show you what to do. Now, Pete needed him. I mean, Pete wouldn't have hired him on a bet. It wasn't charity. Now, he could do the job. He couldn't get the job, right? I say all of that to say I've never seen it fail. Here's what happened to me. I'm sober a year and a half. The guy who made the first 12-step call ever made on me, long story short, and connections, he was the executive director of probation and state probation programs. And when I was sober, I don't know, 19, 20 months, I went to work. Here I am one day on a Sunday, and on Monday, I'm an officer of the court. And no education, no nothing. And it wasn't charity. I could do the job. I just couldn't get the job. So what I'm trying to say, this is what I'm trying to say. To the best of my knowledge, whatever's necessary in life for our fulfillment will be provided through no effort on our own if we practice these principles to the best of our ability. Whatever's necessary to be removed, what will hinder or harm our fulfillment in life, no effort on our own will be removed. The principles are perfect. Anything that'll reverse a killer illness, I mean, check it out. Almost anything has better odds than that. If you look at the way that I'm gonna stop, David. 8 o'clock. Trust me. He's jumping up and down back there. If you can get to the bottom of the ninth step, think about this with me now. The way the program's laid out, if you can get to the bottom of the ninth step, what you got for life is a jet engine. Because there ain't no past and there ain't no future. A guy actually said that one time. It sounds a little lofty when you first think about it, but if you filter it, think about it. He said, there ain't no past and there ain't no future. All there is eternity, and you're pulling it right now. It's always right now. So the way that works in real time, if I get in a fight with my wife, we're not laying it on top of the last 20 years because there is no past. It's a brand new fight. Right? So if you can get to the bottom of the ninth step, there is no need to come from behind because we've squared that up to the best of our ability. There is no future because the future's in the power of right now. That's where God's at. That's where I'm at. That's where we're all at right now. Everybody in this room is safe right now, no matter what we got going on. If you look at what's going on in this room, we got some of everything in the world going on in here. If you take the illness of alcoholism out of us, that what we come together around, we're just like any other group of people. We've got everything in the world going on. Some people in here are so happy they can't hardly stand it, and some people are barely hanging on. You know, I've had times in my sobriety, I might have just been awfully shallow, but I was, for long periods of time, I was just as happy as you could be. I went through periods of time where I didn't know if I could make it through the night. I've had two times in my sobriety, at 8 years and at 19 and a half years. Both of those periods, Bill Wilson called it a dark night of the soul, but both of those times were from 6 months to a year. The best I can describe that pain is it made being homeless seem like kid stuff. It felt like I was being choked spiritually. But here's what I know. If you hang on and you keep going and you just keep practicing these principles to the best of your ability, no matter how poorly that is, the way clears. The way clears. And we don't solve problems here. What we do is practice principles. And then one day we're on the high road. So anyway, I appreciate your hospitality and all the kindness that's been shown to me, the nice place to stay and all of that. And I guess what I would like to say in closing is by the grace of God, power of Alcoholics Anonymous, thank you for my life.
Thank you guys for joining us tonight. We are now going to pass the seven tradition basket, and the seven tradition states every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. While contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses, the seventh tradition is essential at every level of AA service. It is both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their inner group, central office, local services, district, area, and general service office remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose, to help the alcoholic who still suffers. Although the amount of our contribution is secondary to the spiritual connection that unites all groups around the world, we may want to remember that a dollar does not support as many services as it used to. And while those are going around, does anybody have any AA-related announcements?
Great.
No? All right. Somebody said it. All right. And Simple Actions is a home group. If you are interested in joining our home group, please see one of us after the meeting. Home group members, raise your hand. All right. Newcomers, is there anybody here in their first 30 days of sobriety so that we can welcome you?
Hi, I'm Jennifer, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Jennifer, welcome. Yes, sir? Hey, yes. Welcome. Anybody else? No? Okay, we have literature over here to your left. The books are for cost, and the pamphlets, please feel free to take those. Sponsorship. Sponsorship in AA is yours for the asking. We urge you, do not delay. If you have questions or would like additional information about sponsorship, please come see me after the meeting. I'll be right up here. And a reminder, smokers, please use the buck cans provided outside. Stay well away from the church doors. And we have all meeting audio recordings and upcoming events posted on our website, simpleactions.net. And finally, can we thank our speaker one more time? And can someone read the last two paragraphs on page 164 for us?
I'll do it.
Thank you.
Alcoholic David.
David.
Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously, you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.
Thank you. And we will now close with the Lord's Prayer.
Our Father, who art in heaven,